Good afternoon and welcome to Digging Deep. I am your host, Joseph Childs, along with my co-host, Philothea Beeson. This show airs every last Saturday of the month at noon. This is a show that started off with Who's in the Kitchen, talking about food with Philothea, and now we're going to talk a little bit about where the food comes from in this farming show. This is WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this episode as well as many other archival episodes of other great podcasts on WDRT.org. Today, we are sitting down with Jacob Malat. Jacob is an engineer by trade and lives over by the Eastman area and has some farmland in the family and is somewhere around a year or two into his regenerative farming journey. And I'll let Jacob introduce himself a little bit more here. I really appreciate you stopping by, Jacob. You're kind of in the spot that I was in a couple years ago of, you know, finding out that this regenerative agriculture stuff is pretty cool and getting involved in it. So I'll let you introduce yourself here.
Yeah, glad to be here, Joe. Glad you invited me to join today. Jacob Malat. My background is in engineering. Went to University of Wisconsin-Platteville, have a degree in environmental engineering, and have since been working as a wastewater engineer. And all that is great, but somewhere along the line, I really discovered this passion for what I'll call regenerative agriculture and a local agriculture movement. I largely got into it because of the kind of the healthy food side of it. I've always been into fitness and sports and things, and then I really got into like the nutritional aspects of it, and that's kind of what drove me down this rabbit hole. But since that time, I've really developed a passion for even just like the whole system, the farming part of it. You know, I started with chickens, and then I got pigs, and now I even have sheep. Have kind of done the whole gardening thing alongside of it. So a lot of the food that I'm eating and my family's eating, I'm raising, growing, and I really enjoy that piece of it. But as I dig more and more into this, I learn more. The people are awesome. I love interacting with the people that I come across. They're just very like down to earth people. They get it. They understand that the system that we've developed, maybe as a whole in agriculture, probably isn't suiting us correctly. And they're curious and they're open to questioning things. And I really enjoy that.
Well, when you talk about the system that we've developed, what time period are you talking about? And can you describe what system people are beginning to question?
Yeah. For me, the way I understand it is a lot of the large industrial scale agriculture that we see, monocropping, so like single crop, whether it's corn, soybeans, which is popular here, or maybe small grains or things elsewhere. Or like CAFOs, you know, just large concentrated feeding operations and the large dairy industries that we've developed. A lot of that, from the way I see it, was developed post-World War II. We were kind of in a feed-the-world mentality. A lot of the world had been destroyed from war. And food production, just we needed to increase yield, basically. And we've kept a lot of that mentality even still to this day. But the way I see it, and I think what a lot of people are questioning is, there's a few companies kind of at the top that are, or a few people at the top of some large companies that are profiting a lot from this system. But all along the way, farmers and ranchers are really dwindling in terms of like the margins that they're seeing from their products. And a lot of it has to do with kind of this conventional method where it's all about yield. There's not a lot of focus on food quality. It's more of a food quantity thing. And from my understanding and the research that I've done, a lot of this came out of the the research that was put into World War II and wartime, whether it was like bombs and things where they, a bomb, from my understanding, is nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus are huge pieces of that. And so a lot of the research that went into that, they also kind of found out, if we apply this to the soil, we can really explode plant growth, things like that. And that has kind of stuck with agriculture to this day. But the missing, or what we're missing in that picture is there's a lot more going on in the soil, plants interacting with microbes, soil microorganisms. And that piece kind of, that relationship gets changed when you're just applying synthetic fertilizers. And then obviously we've started to apply different types of chemical pesticides, insecticides, things like that have some downstream effects that we maybe didn't originally notice, but they're definitely being seen right now. And so I think people in this regenerative ag movement are questioning some of those things. Is that the right way to do it?
So you talked about the, you know, what has changed in farming as far as the practices that we use, and, you know, the tools that we use, the pesticides, the fertilizers, herbicides. The other thing that suffers when we change that, because it wasn't just the practices, it was really a mindset shift that completely went from, you know, we're feeding our family, our neighborhood, our country, to feeding the rest of the world. The mindset shift from there also had some really detrimental effects on the soil, not just from the soil health standpoint, but the practices that we utilize in order to produce, produce all this food. So there really is a ripple effect from, you know, it's not just that we're producing more food, it's that we're producing that at the detriment of everything else. We don't really care about if we're getting erosion, if we can still produce the same amount of food or more food on that plot next year. So there really was a ripple effect from that mindset shift, not just here's this new cool fertilizer that's going to help you. It's the mindset of the country that shifted, and then that just really started us down a slope that it's slippery, and it's hard to stop and get a foothold and climb back up. Mm-hmm. When this, it's not just a even if we had practices that could reverse that, we would have to completely shift the mindset of the American farmer, the American society, mm-hmm. the American trade ideals that we have of, you know, we want to export everything. That's a really monumental lift, because that is what drives the policies that are in place, the subsidies that are in place. Is really the mindset of we have to do this in order to feed the world, which may have been true at the time. I don't think is true now. I think there's there are very capable countries around the world of feeding themselves, and we really just dump cheap, massive amounts of food on them, which inherently destroys their local food market that small farmers aren't able to sell into because it is saturated and flooded with American cheap grains.
Wow, you could go in so many directions from that. But what I was thinking about was the Dust Bowl, and that was actually before World War II, during the Depression. And, I mean, I don't know if you can comment on that, but, you know, there were agricultural practices that were really bad. And they took the plains and they were planting grain over and over and over again, right? And they created... they destroyed the soil, and it turned into, then they got these terrible storms and it just blew the dust into the air, and I'm really overgeneralizing, but out of that grew some agricultural policies that were actually positive. They came from Department of Agriculture and were taught at universities and things like that, the ag schools around the country, about rotating crops. And planting in strips and things like that, things that would keep the land from eroding. And now it kind of seems like some of those practices are being less practiced. Can you comment on that? And am I wrong?
I would agree with that. I think a huge piece of what I would term regenerative agriculture is context. And so trying to grow grains in some of those places is probably not appropriate. If you look at some of those environments naturally, you don't see those things growing there. They grow lots of grass and they do a really good job of it. But yes, I would agree that maybe some of those shifts that we made out of the Dust Bowl were positive, but we've kind of shifted back into the mentality that we had at the time of the Dust Bowl for sure. Lots of tillage, monocrops. Maybe less crop rotation, as you're referring to. I think a big piece of it may be kind of the lobbying or infiltration of large companies that have the ear of government and hold a lot of power over government, largely due to the fact that some of these government organizations that are overseeing, are regulating large companies. A lot of their profits, actually, or a lot of the money that comes to run those agencies comes from large companies that they're regulating. And for that reason, those companies have a lot of lobbying power. And there's a lot of money to be made in agriculture for some of those companies. And I think that's possibly where you see some of these practices, reverting. There's companies with large marketing budgets, lobbying budgets, and they're pushing for things that are going to benefit themselves, but maybe not are best for the larger population as a whole.
Mm-hmm. So I'd hate to be all doom and gloom. There are some good things happening in agriculture, and I think the fact that you're here. Coming from a non-agricultural background is encouraging. I think there's people like you that are coming into the space from a different angle of what general farmers, basically saying like, hey, we'd like to keep farming and keep making a living off of this. It's going to take people that aren't in the agricultural space, consumers and other people that are concerned about their food, their land, their water, their air, coming together and making the push together, because the smaller farmers alone will not be able to make these pushes because our voices get drowned out. So if consumers and producers alike can come together and give a push for more policy, I think that's encouraging to see that it's actually happening in real time right now. I wanted to ask you just on the basis of you getting into the agricultural space, what's a hurdle that you've had to overcome, and how did you do that? Like, what was the first big hurdle that you ran into that you're like, I don't know if this is for me, or maybe you haven't hit that hurdle yet? Can you speak about that?
So for me, I would say I haven't hit the hurdle yet, but it's on the horizon, and I see it, and I'm trying to find ways around it, and it's definitely the financial piece of it. So as an engineer, I do much better than I would as a farmer from a financial standpoint. And trying to figure out how I can make that piece work financially, because I know ultimately that I want to make the transition away from an engineering career and try and do this egg thing full time, but the finances are a challenging piece of it. What I will say with this regenerative egg movement is it's much less infrastructure intensive in terms of I don't need big fancy equipment. Combines, big tractors, things like that. I can do a lot of the work with an ATV and, you got to have fencing and watering and things like that, but the infrastructure needs are a lot less. It's a mobile thing. You can do it on rented land pretty easy. And I think that's really the piece that matters, is you don't necessarily have to own the land to do this stuff. There's ways to do it with rented land. And you know that joke is because you've done it yourself. So I think the finances piece is the tough part. But by interacting with other people that have done this and asking questions and learning, I'm finding ways around it.
Well, let's just talk about some of the expenses of farming. Okay, one of the big challenges is that land prices have just shot through the roof. And people are using land, I think, as investment. They're not farming it. And Joe and I interviewed somebody that was talking about giving an incentive to people who own land but don't farm it, to have some kind of tax break incentive or something like that, so that they would actually use their land for sustainable agriculture rather than just let it grow, unprotected or developed to some other purpose other than farming or residences. I mean, land is just out of sight. So when I bought my land, for $100 an acre. I know that the dollar has really, lost its value, but I mean, it's really shocking. And Joe and I have said, how can a young man like Joe buy a few acres and farm? I mean, there's just no way, because the land is going for like $8,000 an acre, not $100 an acre. So, I benefited from that. But also I heard the other day that some combines are going for $1 million. No, that's ridiculous. How could any farmer ever make enough money farming to pay for the machinery? So the machinery is really expensive, right? And I'm thinking of what some other expenses are, which are, these inputs. I didn't really realize it, but, if you were, have to put all this fertilizer on and herbicides and everything, this is not free. You buy these things, and those companies are making a lot of money on that. And can you let people in on what are some of the other expenses involved in farming? Well, building buildings, I suppose, and shelters and
No, I think you hit on most of them, and I think it's just the truth that if you don't come to it from an ag family, or maybe you made lots of money in some other industry and you came to farming for, you know, some enjoyment purpose, I think it is very challenging to get started. A lot of land values aren't based on what you can produce from the land anymore. They're based on the real estate value of it, which you touched on. And that's why I think it's key to know that you don't have to own the land to implement some of these practices. There are lots of people out there that, whether they bought it at a time when it was $100 an acre, or they made their money elsewhere and they've purchased large chunks of land, but they're not interested in farming. You know, a lot of those people, or enough of them out there, you have to go out and talk to people and interact, but you can find people that maybe they don't want their land tilled and chemicals sprayed on it, and they're more interested in what you have to offer them if you can explain the benefits of what you're trying to do. So I think that's a big piece of it. You know, the farm machinery part, you know, like you hit on a combine. A combine has basically one use. You spend that much money on it, and it can do one thing, which maybe isn't the greatest financial investment when you think of it. So I think you hit on a lot of the expenses, and there's ways around it, but you have to be more creative. And oftentimes you're not getting bank loans or government support to do some of these things that we want to do. It's still doable, but like I said, you have to be creative.
Well, that's one of the things I'm concerned about. And I think when we buy our food at the grocery store, we're really not realizing that a lot of food policy is not encouraging and helping the farmer, or the small farmer, or the regenerative farmer, that we have incentives and we have insurance and things like that that help the larger farmer.
I would venture to say that digging down a little bit deeper into ag policy, when you really look at who it's benefiting, it's not even really benefiting those large farms. Of course, on the balance sheet, it's you know, their income statement is going to show that it's benefiting them monetarily. What it doesn't show is that there are some farmers out there that they don't want to do that. They would much rather have a smaller farm and run less acres. I don't think anyone wakes up in the morning and is like, gee, I'm so glad that I have 2,000 acres of corn and soy that I have to deal with. I got to go plant all of it and spray and buy fertilizer for it. I don't think anyone really just wakes up and wants to do that sort of thing. If given the choice, I would assume, and maybe this is an assumption that I shouldn't make, but I would assume that people would rather have a little bit slower paced life and make a living on less acres and less responsibility, less overhead, less employees, less insurance to deal with, less government programs to jump through hoops for. It doesn't seem to me like a very stress-free life to run that many acres. Unfortunately, the policy is in place that is what they have to do in order to survive. So years ago, decades ago, that large farm family was likely a small farm running a little bit of corn and some grains and some probably dairy cows, maybe some beef or some pigs. And at some point there was a choice that was made of, we're not really making it. Do we sell the farm or do we go get a bank loan? And they're not going to give us a loan unless we double our acreage or double our herd or something. So somewhere along the line, there was a choice. And that choice was made. Some of them sold out. And the ones that sold out sold to the ones that decided to stay in and get a bigger loan. So I don't think the bank system that is revolving around this, I don't think that is generally, it's hard to think of you're getting a $2 million loan and it's not benefiting you. But really, you're just, you're going to pay interest on that. And if you fail, then the next person is going to pay interest on it. So it's benefiting the bank. These policies are benefiting the people that use the low-cost inputs of corn and soy, so companies that are developing ethanol plants and ethanol technology and all this other stuff that is coming from this really, really cheap soy and corn that is subsidized by the U.S. government. So even those policies, they're keeping farmers in business, and yes, some of them are getting massively wealthy off it, but I don't think in the long run that it is beneficial to these farmers, to any farmer. And the sooner that the people that are getting, that are, the people that are getting advantage from this system realize that they're not really getting advantage from it, the quicker it would change. If a large farmer, if you could say, hey, you will knock out all your debt tomorrow, would you take that? But you have to have 100 acres and 40 cows. I think a lot of them would take that deal. They just can't financially do that mm-hmm. because they're so mm-hmm. far under on their farm. Mm-hmm. They own millions and millions of dollars on equipment and infrastructure.
Yes, I don't think people realize how much in debt farmers are, and the banks made that possible by their restrictions mm-hmm. and so forth.
Yeah, real quick, one thing I would add there on that topic is, if you look at statistics, suicide rates among farmers and ranchers are some of the highest in the country, and it largely is that debt piece right there, mm-hmm. Which is unfortunate.
No way out of it.
No way out of it. They don't see a way out anyways. Yeah.
If you offered me $3 million loan today, there's no way I'd take it. Not a chance. I wouldn't even know how to spend the money. I would never want to be on the hook for it. Even if I had a business plan that said, hey, mm-hmm. give me $3 million, I would still, I think there'd be banks knocking down the door to give it to you because they know you're not going to pay that back. If not in your lifetime. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, they own all the assets, they own the infrastructure, they own the land. They're not going to lose money. Mm-hmm. So it's a real catch-22 of, do we sell the farm and get out of business now, or do we take this loan and hopefully stave off bankruptcy for 30 years, mm-hmm. and then my kids can file bankruptcy mm-hmm. on the place?
Wow. Well, this is a dumb question, but how do we get into corn and soybeans? I mean, I don't think either one of those are really food crops for people. What are they for?
Well, they're food crops for our food crops. For beef and pork and chicken, they're food crops, and they're easy to... They're easy to grow. They grow in pretty much any climate. We're in the corn and soy belt, but, out west, it's grains. Not to mention ethanol policy as well. That is really driven the overproduction of corn, is it, because we take a lot of excess corn and we make it into ethanol, and then we have a mandate that all fuel needs to have a certain percentage of ethanol in the United States. And so it's really just finding outlets for the overproduction, because we have this massive surplus of supply, and so they create artificial demand through subsidies.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the issues too with this, when we think of the everything as a whole, like it's a system, and I don't know if there's one thing you can point to and say that's the problem or why do we do this or that. I think we've gotten ourselves so far down the path that we're on. You say why corn and soy? I think to some degree we've gotten ourselves so far down the path that we can't just turn the corner tomorrow or next year. This is a big ship, and there's a lot of pieces playing a part, and they all have their role. We can't turn them all and shift their mindset and mm-hmm. make changes tomorrow. So I think it's important to understand that this is probably a slow process. If change is going to happen, it's not mm-hmm. going to happen fast.
And well, outside of the mindset too, there's the specialized equipment. The $10 million, $20, $30, $40 million ethanol plant. How do you justify that if we don't keep producing corn? So someone's really going to get hung out to dry on that. The $1 million combine with the corn head, and granted you can get different heads for combines, but what if we go to grazing? Well, then the combine sits there empty. These massive storage facilities for corn and soy grains. And so it's not just like an intangible mm-hmm. mindset mm-hmm. shift, and it's not a paper and mm-hmm. black and white policy shift. It is very much we have these hard, physical, tangible things that are specialized. Like, if you own a CAFO, if you own a pig CAFO, you've got 10,000 pigs. Is that valuable to anybody except person raising pigs? No, if I bought that place, it would be money for me that I would have to pay to tear it down. So it's only valuable to another very specialized niche. I shouldn't say niche because it's a massive market, but mm-hmm. but this specialized equipment is only valuable to those if you continue to produce with that specialized mm-hmm. equipment.
I wouldn't doubt that research into like genetic engineering and modification are a huge piece of that too. Those are two crops that have been researched and studied and changed so much that we just have a lot of understanding of them. Corn is a huge source of energy. Soybeans are a huge source of protein and fats, and I think that's probably fat, carbs, and protein are kind of what make up our macronutrients, and that's probably a large piece of those two crops.
Now, is the organic movement, is that a way to kind of like put your feet on the brake and say, I'm going to do a small farm, I'm going to grow a variety of crops, I'm going to find somebody who's going to buy what I have to sell and market it? Is that a way off this treadmill?
It is, to the extent that the market remains somewhat niche, because then you can demand a higher price. But if everyone's organic, then no one's organic. So then it just becomes, again, a race to the bottom of how cheap can you produce it and how much can you produce. So if every farm in the United States was organic, it wouldn't matter. We would still have the system of we need to produce as much as we possibly can, as fast as we possibly can, for as cheap as we possibly can. So it's right now a market that is an outlet for those who want to remain small. But I don't think that is the ultimate answer, because it is still just a means of production. And when everyone switches to that, or if everyone switched to that, the price would go down. You'd have to produce more to meet your income needs. And then it begins again, the how much can you produce for how cheap?
I think I would add, the organic movement, when it started, was great. And the mindset behind it was great, because a lot of those people were seeing the inputs, the fertilizers, the chemical inputs, and realizing, hey, this isn't the route that we want to go. What I have seen has happened since that time is large corporations saw that there was huge profits to be made in organic, and so they started or bought up a lot of these organic farms and have begun implementing a lot of the same poor soil health practices, such as tillage, on these organic farms. And so my mindset is that the regenerative movement, which I hope doesn't get corrupted, but I think may, already kind of started to see that with some large companies, is kind of a step further in that it's implementing a lot of soil health practices that are still missed from an organic movement mindset. So organic is great. It's a step in the right direction. I don't think it goes the whole way, though.
So we're going to take a short break here, just a little station identification. You're listening to Digging Deep. I'm your co-host, Joseph Childs, along with my other co-host, Philothea Beeson. Today we're sitting down here with Jacob Malat. Jacob is an engineer by trade, but is well into his journey into regenerative agriculture. This is WDRT 91.9 FM from the Viroqua Station. You can listen to this episode on WDRT.org along with some other really good podcasts and find archival episodes of all of those as well. So to bring back up what we were just talking about here, so there are a lot of things to consider when talking about, you know, how do we change something like this? And some of it is mindset. Through consumer dollars, you need to have people just choosing to pay for something that is quality instead of just getting it as cheap as you can. But you can only push so far with a mindset shift. Then, you know, eventually some pen has to hit the paper and make it a rule that this is how we do it, or make it a guideline on how you get paid. And I think of the milk market. You know, it's not just a volume thing. There are farmers out there, especially grass-fed farmers, that are really targeting not how much they can produce as far as like liquid milk. They're targeting like, what's my butterfat content, my milk solids. Like, these things are being valued by the creamery or the place that they're sending because it is a quality thing. And I know your journey into regenerative agriculture, Jacob, started with food quality. You're coming at it from a fitness standpoint, a health standpoint. So we're talking a little bit about how you think that could possibly be, you know, an incentive for people to not only buy higher quality food, but for producers to target that instead of a quantity, how many bushels can you sell? It's what is in the food that you're actually selling.
Yeah, I think I've actually come across some cool organizations that are they're trying to create like food density meters and do some different things like that. So I really think in maybe even the near future, there may be some markets where food is priced based on quality rather than just the current kind of quantity system that we have. So I'll be kind of interested to see where that goes. But I think a huge piece of here what I'm terming regenerative agriculture is following soil health principles. And by following these soil health principles, some of which are like keeping the ground covered and minimizing tillage and disturbance and putting or incorporating livestock, there's a few others. But I think a huge piece of that is when you create healthy soil, which is kind of a plant and then a soil microorganism relationship that's going on down there, some really cool science that happens. But when you're creating healthy soil, you're creating plants that are more nutrient dense. And so whether you're eating those plants or the animals that you're eating are eating those plants, you're therefore ingesting healthier food, more nutrient-dense food as a result of that. And so it's important to see that when we perform some of these agricultural practices in kind of a more proper manner, food quality just happens. People become healthier. We have huge health crisis in this country, and a lot of it does come from what we're eating.
The beautiful thing, both the beautiful and dangerous thing of positive feedback loops, meaning one thing makes another thing happen that makes it worse. So it just keeps going. You either spiral down or you spiral up. And it's a beautiful thing when you're spiraling up. When you talked about this just happens. Food quality will happen if you're implementing good farming practices. Erosion will stop if you're implementing good farming practices. Water infiltration happens. All these things happen when you're doing good farming practices, and they're dependent on each other. Unfortunately, that also happens in reverse. If you're not doing that, your food quality goes down, erosion happens, less water getting in, more CO2 being off-gassed. So it's a beautiful and a dangerous thing, these feedback loops. And I've never thought of the way you had put it, of an incentive program based on like metrics of food. If there's technology out there, which I'm sure there is, or they're working on it, to actually measure what is in the food. But there's another system that they use in Europe of paying for the conservation, the ecological services that the farmers offer. And Noel Blanville, I believe. He's a friend of mine from Ireland. I met him through the World Farmers Organization when I was in Rome. He's a great guy. And he actually showed me his government login, like logged right in on his phone. Here's what I made on my ecological services. Here's what I made on the products that I sold. And some years, the ecological services are what keep the lights on at the farm. Is that he makes more money on ecological services from the government versus the products that he sold. Now, that isn't saying it's a subsidized thing. They didn't subsidize the price of the stuff that he sold so that he's incentivized to sell more. They subsidized the practices that he implemented because he is doing a job that the rest of society benefits from. If all the farmers on the ridges put their property in a pasture, the people in the town should pay the farmers on the ridge because they didn't flood out that year because we were able to stop that. So the people that are benefiting from it realize that and say, you know what, we really value the service that you're offering us. We would like to pay you for that service. And I liken it to, all these small towns and villages. They have a parks department. They have a lawn care department, a maintenance department, whatever you want to call it. And we pay them. We pay them to mulch the gardens. We pay them to mow the yards, to fix the roads. That we pay them for these services. Why don't we extend that to outside of these towns and villages? Where I would gladly pay someone that lived around Gay's Mills. I would have gladly paid them in 2008 if they would have been able to infiltrate enough water that we didn't flood out. These are services that we don't see. But in other countries, they have done that. And I think that is kind of akin to the food quality thing that you're talking about.
So I will say that I think it's a bit of a slippery slope if the government is what's funding the farm or the agricultural practices. I think the government can incentivize the correct or proper practices kind of as we make a transition. I think that could be a great benefit. Personally, I think consumers voting with their dollar is a more beneficial way of kind of making this movement stick. But as we hit on before, it's a system, and there's not one way to do it. I think there's lots of angles that we need to attack this from. So can the government help us? Yes. Can people spend money a little bit differently? Absolutely. There's lots of ways to do this, and I think it's going to take all of these different kinds of approaches to actually achieve the outcome that we're looking for. I don't think one of them is going to get us there.
Well, do we really know what crops are being grown regeneratively? I mean, how do we even know to support one thing or another?
There's quite a few companies out there actually right now that are doing regenerative certification, which is, you know, similar to organic certification. I would say it's a little more in depth in terms of getting people out on the farm. It's not so much practice based, but the ones that are, at least the way that I see it, the ones that are doing a really good job of it, they're actually measuring like nutrient density and soil health on the back end to see like, okay, just because you implemented these practices, is it actually resulting in food that is healthier? And I think that's maybe a piece that like something such as the organic certification is just, hey, you take your crop or your land, you can't spray it for 3 years, you can't do this for 3 years, and now you're organic certified. I think it's this regenerative certification that's actually measuring food density outcome at the end is kind of taking it a step further. So yeah, there's some companies that are doing that. There's some good stuff out there. And I've even seen some of these labels pop up in grocery stores, which is kind of cool.
So they could show up on labels. Okay.
And they will be very, very soon, based on the trajectory that I'm seeing.
Yeah, that was a topic at the World Food Forum that was like labeling and how it can be both. It's a double-edged sword. It can be very misleading sometimes, but it's also something. It's a powerful thing to use where people aren't able to go out and visit the farm and say, okay, that is a good, you know, that is a good carrot, that is a good cut of beef, because this is how they're like, this is how they're practicing on their farm. They can't go out there and field verify it for themselves. So having trusted labels is a big thing. And that's not only with organic standards or regenerative standards, but having a brand of, you know, think of the Champagne region of France or Parmesan from Italy. Like these are things that are world known because they're grown in this area specifically. So those are powerful labels for creating small food markets and being able to command a bit of a premium on your products. Like a driftless grown X, Y, and Z could get a higher price for that in this area because you know for a fact that it was grown within this local area. So not only just the standards of the practices they're using, but where it's grown. I think that's almost more important than buying, you know, something with a label on it that says it was grown in a good way, but buying it locally is even better because you can actually go out and field verify that, and it's keeping those dollars within the community.
Yeah, I would just add, I think the key to it is trust. Absolutely, like you said. Whatever you got to do to be able to trust that farmer and trust maybe the nutrient quality or whatever it is, getting out on the farm and putting your eyes on it, that's why buying from a local farmer is you know, the best way to do it. But if you live in inner city New York, New York City, and you can't do that, maybe looking for that regenerative stamp or that organic stamp is the next best thing you can do.
Absolutely. The trust, especially with something as intimate as food, you know, you don't have to trust your clothing provider as much as you have to trust the person that's making your food.
Yeah, you should probably trust your clothing provider too.
I was having a great talk with Jacob about this because there are regenerative clothing, regenerative practices with leather and with fibers, and we could get in a whole hour spent on this, but this fascinates me.
Fascinating, cool stuff.
Yeah, that's a whole another side of farming is really? the non-food crops and
really.
We'll dive into that. Well, I've got to just quickly take a station identification break. You're listening to Digging Deep. I am your host, Joseph Childs, sitting down here with my other host, Philothea Beeson. We're hosting Jacob Malat today. Jacob is an engineer by trade, but well into his journey into regenerative farming. And as you can tell, he's got a lot of stuff that he likes to talk about in it and does some research for himself. And he's well on his way to helping out the regenerative farming movement. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM. You can also listen to this episode and many other great podcasts and their archival episodes on WDRT.org. So do we want to jump down the rabbit hole of linen and other fibers, or do we want to kind of move towards a little bit more food talk here?
I think let's stick with food.
Have you on again, Jacob. This has just been really fun. You're so knowledgeable and articulate. I'm thinking, how old are you? You got a lot of wisdom for such a young man.
I've dove really deep, really fast into this. It fascinates me. And like I mentioned earlier, I enjoy the people that I interact with. But the knowledge is awesome. I love learning. I always have. And so when I find something like this that I'm passionate about, I've went all in and found, you know, as much stuff as I can.
Well, what have you found, say, in reading things or in organizations? Can you share some of the people who've influenced you and given you some information?
I don't know if I would call out specific people, but definitely like specific practices. As I mentioned earlier, soil health practices is kind of a universal thing that I've found, in many different books, podcasts, organizations, events that I've went to. Those are pretty essential, and a lot of people will give you five or six, depending on kind of how you want to look at it. And now that I'm on the spot here, I'll try and remember them. And I definitely am going to forget one or two, but I know one of the biggest ones is context. You know, we hit on trying to grow grains out in some of the Western plains and things like that probably isn't the best thing. So context is huge. Where are you at in the world? Rainfall, topography, things like that are huge. Keeping the soil covered, whether that's through like cover crops or, you know, no-till is a step in the right direction. But if you're applying chemicals and things like that, you know, maybe you're not getting the full benefit. So keeping the ground covered, minimizing disturbance, which is tillage, keeping a living root in the soil for as long as possible during the year. Because as I hit on earlier, there's a relationship between plants and microbes underground. Plants are photosynthesizing, and they're putting out sugar into the ground, and then which is feeding some of those microbes. And then in return for that sugar, microbes and fungi are returning minerals and different things to the plants that they need to grow. And therefore, that's how some of those important minerals end up in our food, and we create food nutrient density and quality that isn't there with some of like the monocrop industrial practices where we're applying nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, kind of the nutrients that the plant needs to grow and stay alive, not necessarily thrive and be healthy. So when we give those things to the plant, it kind of loses the relationship that it needs with soil microbes, and therefore you end up with less nutrient-dense food. And now I'm going to draw a blank, I think, on the last one. But essentially, it's just these soil health principles are a big piece of what I've learned, that regenerative practices, the key to it is improving soil health. You improve soil health and kind of everything else works itself out along the way. Mm-hmm. One of the other big pieces, and I think I hit on this with Joe in conversation before, but like rural communities are dying as a result of industrial practices. As farm profit margins have gotten smaller, farms have had to get a lot larger. Therefore, there's less farms. Now there's less people living in these small rural communities. People have moved to cities where there's more resources, job opportunities, things like that. All of these farm commodities or products get shipped to the city where they get processed. So that's where all the resources and jobs and things are at. If we want thriving rural communities, we just need more farmers. That's what it comes down to. That food is the centerpiece of a thriving rural community. If we want to have schools that have funding, we got to have thriving rural communities. I live in a community, I've grown up in a community where population has dwindled my entire life, and the school keeps getting smaller and smaller. And you see...
they tore down a school in Eastman within your lifetime.
Within my lifetime. I had a brother that went to that school who was 10 years older than me. So I see this happening firsthand, and I think I'm taking a huge interest in like how can I shift this? And I think it's by doing what we're doing here. It's getting the message out and talking about it and letting people kind of go and do their own research and try and understand this. But I think rural communities are based around food. If we have farmers, we need mechanics in town, we need banks to help them out, we need grocery stores in town, local babysitters, just all down the line. It's what keeps a community, a small rural community, thriving.
There's not a job in this area currently. Maybe there's a handful of niche ones here and there, but that don't directly benefit from having a good and robust local food system. I mean, just think of the food system. If we were to have it produced and processed and prepared and sold and everything here, you know, the person to raise it, the veterinarians, people building infrastructure, building fence, building, you know, head chutes, building barns, building sheds, equipment dealers and sellers and repairmen, you know, all sorts of businesses. And that's just the farm aspect, you know, people hauling cattle, people selling cattle, people butchering cattle, people backgrounding cattle, grazing cattle. All this stuff could be, you know, within our community, and it used to be. This isn't a foreign concept. Mm-hmm. This is what it was. This is why there was a cheese factory at every crossroad in every small town, is because they couldn't take the milk that far, and in order to preserve it, you had to turn it into cheese. So these local food systems, we want to talk about jobs, and you know, every politician, if they want to get elected, is saying they're going to bring jobs to the area. Well, bring appropriate jobs. We wouldn't. I mean, maybe this is fully opinion on my end, but I would wager that rural people don't really care if they have a massive data center in the middle of some business park in a rural town. Those jobs are not for us. Those jobs are generally from people getting hired in that are coming here to work those jobs. Having a local food system are jobs that are for the people that live here currently and can attract more people to live here in the future.
Here's one that I see quite often in small communities is, and I don't mean to name names, but just giving a few examples as kind of a way to show what I'm talking about here. But if a Taco Bell or a Walmart or, you know, a Casey's or any of these large corporations are moving into small towns, sure, it's a tax base for that town.
Dollar General.
That's a huge one in rural communities because of the business model that they have. But what if instead we had local mom and pop shops, you know, tons of those that are popping up? Because guess what? That money stays in the community. It doesn't go back to corporate headquarters, wherever that's located.
Yeah, I could never live in Viroqua because I couldn't live in Gays Mills or Soldiers Grove. I like being out in the country. That being said, I currently do live inside Soldiers Grove, but I have, you know, farms out in the country that I can go to. But Viroqua has done an excellent job of revitalizing this downtown Main Street. You know, people come here from across the state to visit this area. And there is a thriving local food, local art scene, local coffee scene, local clothing scene, fishing. Like, this is a good model for what can be done. It doesn't have to be done exactly like this, but it's an example of like, hey, look, us rural people aren't just dumb and have to listen to, you know, be employees at some mm-hmm. just chain. We can do our own thing. We are fully capable of doing this. We are not lesser than someone who is in a city. Like, we're not mm-hmm. we're not dumb people. Like, just allow us the environment to thrive, and we will thrive.
There is an example of the Vernon Economic Development Association, VEDA, which founded Food Enterprise Center, and that's an opportunity for people to process food in a huge facility that used to belong to National Cash Register, and they left, and, you know, we lost 70 jobs here. And over the period of time, I'm just really impressed with VEDA and the work that they have done. And that was a totally nonprofit. It wasn't government at all, and they have just, you know, local support for that. So we have possibility of producing products, value-added products from what's grown in the area. And, you know, farmers markets are always wonderful and welcome, and we have a food co-op here that buys from local producers. Some people come from other cities to come to Viroqua to buy the food at the food co-op.
The farmers market here is incredible, too.
You know, so, and then you have the, I can't even remember the name of it, but, you know, food boxes where people, you know, join.
Oh, CSAs.
CSAs, which is wonderful. And these can even reach cities. So looking out for CSAs that are coming to your city, because they often, you know, have a drop-off place, and they'll supply you with a box every week all during the growing season, and you can get to know growers that way and go visit their farms and help out, help your children to, you know, make the connection with food and where it comes from. And we really do have a lot of people who participate in local ventures like protecting our watersheds. I mean, a lot of people don't even know what a watershed is. Out here, people are aware of the part of the river that they live on, and, you know, they're concerned about soil erosion, quality of the water, and trout streams, and things like that, and flood prevention, and people attend farmers' union meetings, and, you know, I really just encourage people to find something that interests them that they can acquaint themselves with that is actually accomplishing something. Could be very, very low level.
Yeah.
Not too intellectual, just something that you can do.
And I work for a nonprofit. I have for the last 3 years, and it's an extremely rewarding job, but you also get to see, you know, there is a bright side to this. There are people that are willingly supporting this with $50, there's willingly supporting with thousands of dollars. People are willing to support these causes, and it's encouraging to see that, because you hear about a lot of the doom and gloom, and when you look at government policy and all the politics, and it's just like you're banging your head against a wall. You can go out to any group. You look in the paper, there's 7 events this weekend probably where you can get involved with something that you're probably interested in. It doesn't have to be farming, but just getting involved and showing your support for things is how, you know, we talked a little bit about how Organic Valley got started, and that was just farmers getting together and say, hey, we want to do it this way. Can we think we can gather enough support to get this thing going? And it got going, and boy, did it ever get going. So it's these things are, you know, they're hard, laborious pushes, but they're pushes that can be done. It just takes a lot of people, and it takes a lot of energy, and fortunately that doesn't cost money.
I think something important to hit on here is what we have going on here in Viroqua is special. I think that's number one, like to understand that and realize that, but also understand that this can be used as a model. We don't want to necessarily take what we have going on here in Viroqua and just expand it and make it really big. I think it's important to understand that we need to take this and make it exist in every region of every state and county and, you know, all over the United States. You know, there's a few examples of this that I know of around the country, but not enough. It's important that we take this, we find an example of something that works, but also understand that context is important and what works here doesn't work everywhere. You know, start one of these movements, start where you're at, I guess. You know, that's important. Start where you're at and let it grow from there. You know, get a few people involved and eventually over time things will expand and grow. But we need more stuff like this to exist elsewhere.
Absolutely. And you talked about context earlier. You know, this Viroqua is a great place. It's not everyone's cup of tea, and no place is. So, like, this worked here because of the people that are here, because of where the situation that is in, because of the history of it. And I do think the model of the process of how this happened, it was people that decided, you know what, we're gonna do what we're gonna do, and if you want to come and help support, then come on in. And that's, you know, a town, say, like Prairie du Chien. If they could do this, it wouldn't look like Viroqua, and that's good. It's Prairie du Chien, or it's, you know, or it's Westby, or it's Reedstown, or it's Soldiers Grove. But getting involved with your neighbors and saying, "Hey, here's what I love about being here. Here's where I still live here. Let's focus on that." Like Viroqua's got this kind of like weird vibe that everyone loves that lives here, and that's what they ran with. You know, a town like Steuben or something that lives right on the river, run with that. Or, you know, what makes your community unique? Celebrate it, promote it, support it, and it can turn into something that is a destination for people to come. And like I would willingly pay more to live here and eat food from here because I like what's going on here, and there's other people like me here.
Important message: get involved in your community. I think that is just vital for a rural community to stand out. We need more people involved, more community events, We don't necessarily need to go shopping in the next local big city. You know, spend your Saturday involved at the farmers market or community events. So just get involved.
It would really help our political situation, I think. Being involved in your local community is just healthy. Get involved and not think that it's up to somebody else to solve the problems. It really is inspiring to see that two or three people can get something going. I was telling Jacob that, I mean, I've been here 50 years, but we had, you know, a couple of meetings. We said, wouldn't it be nice if we had a radio station here, community radio? Now we have one, and it's been going for about 15 years. And, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, an alternative school? Well, we have one, and it started 40 years ago, and it's still going. And how about a place where we can sell our organic produce? How do we do that? Now we have Organic Valley. It's just amazing. It's amazing. Two or three people gathered together who have some energy and some imagination. There's a wonderful parade that got started by some kind of artistic people, I guess. It's a harvest parade that happens in Viroqua every year. And they made these people get together for months in advance and make paper mache puppets and, you know, the huge ones, you know, that you walk on stilts and you have this huge... And it's like something for everybody to come around and see. And then we do have so many. I could just name a lot of things going on in the community that really, who has the World's Fair here? And it's like a little town of about, you know, 40 people. And they have a World's Fair and they have a parade and everybody, you know, rides their bicycles and drives their tractors. Mm-hmm. And then there's the, you know, Viola Horse and Coach Show. And you can start with these wonderful local things and it makes you love where you live. It makes you love the people who are there. And you want to add to it. So, yeah, get to know your neighbors.
I've got another example, Cazenovia. I don't know if you've been where Weston School is located. I've always been jealous of that little town. They still have a little grocery store. They've got Lee Lake over there. They still have the Cazenovia Reds hometown talent team, and they're one of the smallest, like they are the smallest school in our conference, in the Ridge and Valley Conference, and they still their school is still going. Like that town, and I'll give a free shout out to Jeffrey Evan because he is a huge, huge part of that town, and really the vitality of that, and just seeing. You know, his posts that, you know, the community coming out and raising money for lights at the field and cleaning up the lake, and they do a polar plunge every year. And it's like these little towns where you drive through and if you blink, you know, you're going to miss it. And they still have these things going on. So it really does take just a few people to get interested and passionate about where they live to really improve it. And hopefully we can retain those people through some, you know, economic stuff. Because I do believe we need to have people, places for people to work, can't all work from home. So we do need to have that, but within reason that makes sense and that is beneficial to the community, not just to the business. So I like how we really did bounce around here. We started talking about farming, but the first thing you said was the community and the regenerative agriculture space is really what drew you in, like not a specific person. But the community. So it's no coincidence that we kind of circle back around and talking about small communities again.
Yeah, I think real quick, it's important or something cool for me to hit on is just I've here in the last year or two, I've traveled quite some distance. I was recently out in Montana, and then just last weekend I went to Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm out in Virginia. Both of those times, I didn't know a single person. I traveled alone, didn't know a single person when I got there, but left with lots of great friends. And the reason that happened is I could have a conversation with any person there and they understood the concepts behind what we're talking about here today. They get it. They question why we are maybe still moving in the wrong direction, at least from a large scale industrial agriculture model. So it's just cool being able to have conversations with those people. And they're some of the most down to earth, incredible people that I've met in my life.
Well, that's it.
we could go on and on. Sorry to cut it off here, but this has been a great conversation, Jacob. I assume that you're probably going to be back here probably a couple more times to talk with Phil Thea about this stuff because it's really interesting. It's really it's really enlightening to see, you know, compare my journey with yours as how you're getting into this, and it seems to go like right along the same track as you just dive headfirst into it. And then it envelops you, and you just want to do everything you can to kind of push this movement forward. So it's cool to see someone else going into that. But we've got to take a break here until next time Jacob comes back. So you've been listening to Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Joseph Childs. Sat down here with Jacob Malat and Philothea Beeson today. You can find this episode on WDRT.org along with many other episodes and other podcasts. So thanks for tuning in. Bye.